this topic is to some extent overtaken by events, as so often happens. That is to say, a couple of days ago, Congress did raise the debt ceiling, and so the question, which implicates Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, but not only Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, what happens if the government faces a cash shortfall has been avoided. But these things do tend to come back, and one thing that sort of, I was looking at the legislation that raised the debt ceiling, and it also has the spending caps for starting, I guess, in the next fiscal year. And they take the form of restrictions on overall amounts of spending in annual appropriations at very high levels of generality, like security is one of them, and security gets reduced by a certain amount. And the way it operates, all this is just by way of introduction, but it makes an interesting point. The way it operates is that if Congress in whatever later year is involved, 2014, ostensibly say 2015, fails to meet the targets that are in the statute that was just adopted, the Secretary of the Treasury is supposed to sequester funds, that is to say, just pro rata, reduce a whole bunch of appropriations. And the idea is, well, that would be astonishingly stupid. And now listen to this reasoning. That would be astonishingly stupid, and so Congress would never allow it to happen. And that, so that the force of the threatened sequestration will cause Congress actually to make rational decisions. And one thing that's interesting about that is that, and you can see this in the statutory text, because the new caps take the form of amendments to the Balanced Budget and Emergency, notice it was an emergency, Deficit Control Act of 1985, that which is, say, Graham Rudman Holling. Some of you will have heard of it. Some of you, I think, were not born in 1985, or just around then.
Or prefer not to think about it.
So there has been a fiscal emergency at least since 1985. And those of you, I don't know how many of you know about this, Graham Rudman Hollings was not a complete success. It did not actually cause the federal government to be budget to be balanced. So what will come of this, we do not yet know. But the fact that a very similar problem did arise in the mid-1980s and was given a somewhat similar solution does suggest that this is not the last time these questions are going to come up. So the fact that the bullet was dodged at this particular time does not mean that the general problem involved in particular Section 4 of the 14th Amendment are just irrelevant. The next thing I want to say, just by way of setting up the problem, and I asked you to read a little bit about this, so I'll just talk about it quite briefly, is to describe at a very high level of abstraction the fiscal operations of the federal government and how problems like the problem that the government just ran into happen. Here's a quick question. What is the most fundamental power of Congress? And that was wholly rhetorical. Nobody has to answer that. The most fundamental power of Congress is, of course, the power to tax. Money is the sinew of war, and war is the health of the state. The second most important power of Congress is the power to borrow money, the other way to raise the cash. And those are the powers with which the list of congressional powers in Article 1, Section 8 starts. The framers of the Constitution understood that was fundamental, and probably the single largest change between the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution was to give the new federal government its own source of revenue, both the borrowing power and, well, because you can't really borrow if nobody thinks they're going to pay, the power to raise taxes to pay off the debt. So federal borrowing, federal taxes are created by statutes enacted by Congress pursuant to specific constitutional authorization. Interestingly, and contrary to what some of you may have heard in con law, there is no explicit federal power to spend money. There are various other powers that Congress has, and pursuant to them, like raise and support an army, hard to raise and support the army without spending some money on it, lots of ways in which Congress has authority to spend money. There's not a general, at least not a specific, not an explicit general federal a spending power, but there is plenty of congressional authority to spend money. And there's another provision in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 9, Article 1, Section 9 is the one that has limitations on Congress. So it's the one that says Congress can't grant titles of nobility. So your ambition to be Duke or Duchess of Albemarle County is just not going to be fulfilled short of a constitutional revolution. There is an explicit limitation that says no money shall be drawn from the Treasury except to pursuant to an appropriation by law. That is to say, the executive can't spend money on its own, a point of considerable importance if you think a little bit about the historical antecedents of the Constitution. So taxation, borrowing, spending, all done, all executed by the executive branch, and in this case, all handled by the Department of the Treasury, but all pursuant to statute. Congress says how much to borrow. Congress says what the taxes are going to be. Congress says how much to spend. That is all in the statutes. And that then creates the question, okay, what happens when the system sort of, when the gears don't grind together quite properly? One phenomenon that is fairly familiar that happens every few years is what's called a government shutdown. And one of the things I want to make, and I put this in the introduction, but I want to say it again because it's quite important. One thing that's important to see is a shutdown is not the same thing as what almost just happened this past week. Shutdowns happen because the bulk of congressional appropriations are annual appropriations. There are a large category of congressional appropriations that aren't annual, that just continue unless the Congress repeals them. The most important examples of non-annual permanent appropriations are for Social Security and Medicare. There are statutes that just say this much money is going to be spent on Social Security. Well, actually, what they say is however much you need is going to be spent on Social Security and Medicare. And they are standing statutes. They don't need to be renewed every year. But the majority of the federal budget, which is over $1 trillion these days, is done in annual appropriations. And most of you are at least somewhat familiar with the annual cycle. In January, the president sends a budget. People in Congress scoff at it. And they spend the next several months yelling at one another. And eventually something usually happens. But not always. And in the not always situation where something doesn't happen, you have the situation where Congress has not appropriated funds in the annual, has not adopted an annual appropriation either for the entire government or for some agencies. And in that situation, there's no problem with cash in the Treasury. The Treasury has cash, but because the Constitution says no money can be spent except pursuant to an appropriation, if there's no appropriation, then the agencies can't operate. And that's how you get the excellent spectacle of the Park Service shutting down the Washington Monument. And they shut down the Washington Monument because it takes money to run the Washington Monument, and if they don't have any money, they're not allowed to do it. And indeed, there is a statute saying that the government can't accept volunteer services designed for the situation in which there's no appropriation. Congress not wanting to get into the position of having all these people continue to work and there was no appropriation, and Congress then has to decide what to do about it. Anyway, that's a government shutdown. I will now tell you my favorite government shutdown story, which is, unlike so many good stories, it's probably not true, but it is so good that I can't resist telling it. And many of you know, and many of us will recall, that there was one of these budget confrontations, and I guess it was 1995, between the Gingrich Congress and President Clinton, and there was a government shutdown. And when there is a government shutdown, people are not allowed to come into work, or at least people who have to be paid a salary are not allowed to come into work. But at some parts of the government, there are people who aren't paid anything. They are, for example, unpaid interns. And the story goes exactly that during the shutdown, the people whose job it was to keep the bimbos away from the president all had to go home because there was no appropriation, and an intern came in with the pizza, and history was made. And so the fulcrum of American history is, in fact, the Anti-Deficiency Act. The Anti-Deficiency Act is the statute that says people can't come to work without an appropriation. Yes.
So what's going on with the FAA?
Yeah.
The FAA has another problem.
Okay, but no. The volunteer people, there are people that are asking to work without pay.
The air traffic controllers.
Right.
Well, that's right. That yes.
Inspectors,
good
question.
Good question.
Inspectors.
Yes. The Anti-Deficiency Act, which has been amended a couple of times in the last 30 years in response to things like this, has an exception for accepting volunteer services. John may remember the exact phrasing, but it is for people. What is it? Essential for the protection of life and property.
Hitting one another
is
so
regarded
they can,
as
they can
so,
ask
yes,
them to
yes,
volunteer.
Yes, there is an exception to the Anti-Deficiency Act, and as I said, the statute was changed maybe 20 years ago or so to make it narrower. Because before that, presidents had been exercising a lot of discretion as to what to allow to continue to happen during shutdowns. And interesting question, what does Congress want? Some people in Congress wanted the shutdown actually to operate coercively. And so they narrowed what's allowed under the Anti-Deficiency Act. But it does permit air traffic controllers. Interestingly, I can't stop talking about this stuff. I'm so fascinated by it. What's been going on with the FAA, I think this is true, is not a failure of the FAA's annual appropriation. It is a failure of the substantive statute that authorizes the FAA to operate at all.
Hmm.
And that's why the players on this are not the chairs of the appropriations committees in Congress, but the committees in Congress that have substantive oversight authority over the FAA. The House and the Senate have been in it. There was some temporary FAA. Program. I think this was one for subsidizing small airports.
Yeah.
And there was a fight between the House and the Senate as to whether to continue the program. And it's not just, again, not the appropriation for it. It would be like, you know, eliminating the Department of Education or something like that, not having the program at all. And that is what is causing the problem with the FAA. So that's not an appropriations problem. That is there going to be a statute saying the government can do this at all? And the Congress and the House and Senate are at loggerheads. Anyway, that was sort of an introduction to federal fiscal law. The other situation, that's a shutdown. The other situation in which there can be this kind of problem is what almost just happened, and that's a cash shortfall. And the thing about a cash shortfall is it's not a situation in which there's a problem with legal authority to spend the money. It's the situation in which there isn't any money to spend, in which the Treasury does not have sufficient funds to pay its debts. And the Treasury's two main sources of funds, overwhelmingly, are taxation and borrowing. These days, the government is substantially in deficit, and that means it does a lot of borrowing. And so was it today? Did they auction Treasuries today? Is it on Wednesday? I'm not sure.
I think that's right, because I think that's why
that was the deadline. Right. I think the reason they were saying it had to be done by Tuesday is this morning, the Department of the Treasury sold a whole bunch of debt again and got cash, and so this afternoon they can pay the bills.
So they've
kited the check for about a day.
So they couldn't issue the debt without the legislation that passed it.
Exactly.
They were at the ceiling,
precisely. What causes the shortfall is the fact that the two possible sources of revenue are not enough to meet the appropriations. Congress has said spend many, many, many billions of dollars and get the many, many billions of dollars in these two ways, by borrowing and by taxation. And, this is a crucial part of the story, the debt ceiling statute says, but the Treasury Department can only borrow the following total amount of money. It's a very large amount of money, but it is finite. There are three provisions of law primarily that say the Treasury Department can borrow money on the credit of the United States in order to pay appropriations. And then there's the debt ceiling. And the debt ceiling is another statute. It's right in that series. And it says, but the total amount borrowed can't be above this dollar amount. And at that point, the Treasury is in the position where it's not legal to sell any more debt of the United States in exchange for cash. But without the additional cash, it's not possible to meet the appropriations. So you've got a series of statutes that are inconsistent with one another when you take them all together. If you put together the appropriation statutes, the taxing statutes, and the borrowing statutes, and in particular the debt ceiling that says only so much borrowing, there's not enough cash in order to pay all the appropriations. That's what almost happened this week. And the question is, does Section 4 of the 14th Amendment have any bearing on this? Does Section 4 affect this? The Section 4 is well, as part of the 14th Amendment, and hence it was proposed and adopted in the 1860s. And I think I was going to bring my one of my pocket constitutions. I forgot to bring that, but here is Section 4 on the handout. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payments of pensions and bounties for services and suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned, but neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slaves. But all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. And I think there's a missing quotation mark there. I'm very embarrassed about that. Please don't tell anyone that happened. Failed to close the quotation. George Rutherglen can confirm or deny what I'm about to say about the history of Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, which is the main, as is routinely the case in the 14th Amendment, the first part is not the important part. The really important part of the 14th Amendment as a whole was Section 2,
right,
followed by Section 3. But of course, Section 1 is nevertheless Section 1. The whole thing's kind of indirection, head fake. Similarly, in Section 4, the most important part is the second sentence, the one that says, no, the states, now that slavery's been abolished, the states can't decide to do what's called compensated emancipation. And it's important to know that in the history of sort of Anglo-American slavery, there had been a number of major episodes of compensated emancipation. That is to say, points at which some state or Britain for its colonies decided to abolish slavery, but to compensate the slave owners out of public revenue and say, we've just eliminated an enormous, like a taking, we've just eliminated an enormous amount of your property and we're going to pay you for it. Britain did that when they abolished slavery in the Caribbean colonies. The federal government did that when it abolished slavery during the Civil War in the District of Columbia. Slave owners got a payment from the Treasury in compensation for their slaves. There weren't that many slaves in the District of Columbia, but there were a whole lot in the South. And Congress did not want even to allow the possibility of that enormous compensation, either from the federal government or, because you never knew who was going to be in charge of the federal government 10 years later, either from the federal government or the states. And hence they had Section 2, the second sentence of Section 2, and also they were concerned that at some point in the future, one of the Confederate states that had seceded might try to pay the debt that it had incurred during the Civil War. So interestingly, although the first sentence it basically says no repudiation of the public debt of the United States, the point of the second sentence is to repudiate some debts. The point of the second sentence is to say, all that money you lent the Confederate states in order to conduct the rebellion, you're not getting it back. And it would be unconstitutional to give it back. My understanding, and again, George, tell me if this is right, is that politically, is it practically the second sentence was more important. That's what they were actually worried about. And that the first sentence was just sort of an early example of waving the bloody shirt. And the way, so that's a phrase some of you will be, you know what, yeah, I see you smiling. What does it mean to wave the bloody shirt?
I don't know.
You hadn't heard that phrase before? It's such a great phrase.
It's a funny phrase.
Exactly. It was a campaign tactic by Republicans in elections for the next 30 or 40 years after the Civil War. And the bloody shirt would be the bloody shirt of the Union veteran. And this would be the argument that the Democrats are the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. So even if you were in favor of rum and Romanism, which many people were, you had to be against rebellion. And so they would wave the bloody shirt of the Union soldier, bullet marked by the armies of treason. Anyway, my personal thought about the first sentence is it really was just a way of I guess what we would call energizing the base today. that is to say that it's the Republicans saying those evil Democrats are planning to say that the Civil War, fighting the Civil War for the Union, was unconstitutional, and they are going to refuse to pay the Union veterans. And refused to pay because, as you can imagine, as of 1866, the United States had borrowed a whole lot of money to pay this to fight the Civil War, and indeed part of the story of the always money is the sinew of war and war is the health of the state. The story of the Civil War is in large part a story of federal fiscal law. It is a story of how to raise these enormous sums of money on the capital markets as they existed in the early 1860s. Anyway, so that's section one got in there, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law. Please.
Do you think the banks that lent all that money to the federal government got it stuck in because they were a little worried
That's a good question, right?
Might not be paying off on their bonds they were holding.
That is at least possible. As far as I can tell, it was not a serious possibility. But on the other hand, if you were a bank and you were holding unprecedented amounts of federal debt, you might want two or three pairs of suspenders to go with your belt. So it is certainly true that the Civil War stretched the fiscal capacity of the United States government almost to the breaking point, and stretched the ability of American banks to supply credit to the government almost to the breaking point. There's a fascinating article by Ken Dam about why the legal tender legislation, the legislation saying United States notes are going to be legal tender during the Civil War, was really necessary in order to keep the Wall Street banks going, because otherwise, they might have collapsed, and the Union wouldn't have had anybody to borrow money from. So, yeah, whether it was a real practical problem or just yelling at the Democrats, interesting question. It was at least just yelling at the Democrats, but what?
I have a question. You mentioned that the second sentence was most important, mm-hmm. but when they say here the public debt shall not be questioned, mm-hmm. the article we read raises a lot of issues about who that, by whom. It should not be mm-hmm. questioned by whom, the people, mm-hmm. the president, the Congress. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's not the critical part of the amendment?
I historically speaking, I mean, we're about to talk about the first sentence, absolutely. That's the actual topic.
Okay.
But it is one of these standard historical ironies that, as I say, for the 14th Amendment as a whole, Section 2 was the really important part. But now all nobody knows what Section 2 says. I mean, any of the students here know what Section 2 says? You see? Perfect. It was like this, overtaken by events.
Times change.
They do that. But now, the first sentence of Section 4 is still there. And it raises the big question about it, and this is the sort of the first thing I'm getting there in section the first part of the outline. Here is how I'm going to put the question. And this is a slightly technical terminology, so I'm going to define what I mean. The question that Abramowitz is writing about, that Secretary Geithner was talking about, that all the law professors were blogging about, you know, Larry Tribe and Mike McConnell and Jack Balkin and so forth, is the first sentence limited to congressional repudiation, or does it go beyond that and deal with the possibility of default? And that there's a difference between repudiation and default. And the terminology isn't always used precisely, but I'm about to use it precisely. For a government to repudiate its debts is what happened in the second sentence of Section 4. That's for a government to say, debt, what debt? That was illegal, and therefore we are not going to pay it. And one of the things that the people who drafted the 14th Amendment knew was that during the 1830s, state governments borrowed an enormous amount of money, basically for infrastructure projects, for canals and railroads and highways. They borrowed an enormous amount of money, does this sound familiar? And then there was a huge financial collapse, the Panic of 1837. And the Panic of 1837 dramatically restricted credit and dramatically reduced economic activity. So here were all these new canals and roads and railroads and no customers. And as a consequence, a whole lot of states couldn't pay their debts. And some of them said, sorry, we can't pay our debts. We're going to have to work something out. That is what I mean by default. They just said, you're right, we owe you money, but, you know, cupboard's bare. Let's negotiate. Whereas a couple of states said, you know those debts that those criminals who previously occupied the legislature of our state entered into? That was unauthorized. That was illegal and hence void ab initio. And so we don't owe you the money at all. That's repudiation. That's saying that debt has no ongoing legal validity. Earlier this year, I don't know if any of you noticed this, the city of Harrisburg defaulted on a huge bond issue to build something. You saw this?
Yeah, I read it in the newspaper.
Yeah, what, do you remember what? I'm trying to remember. It was some vast project.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What was it? Obviously, it didn't work. I think it was like, was is it possible it was in a bunch of incinerators?
I can't remember.
It's some trash-related program. You know, there's a lot of money in trash.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Harrisburg borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars to build whatever they were. I think they were incinerated, but I'm not sure. Borrowed hundreds of millions of dollars, and they thought, oh, we'll generate massive revenue from all this incineration. And it turned out that all they were actually burning up was the money they put into building the incinerators. And they couldn't pay. And so they are in default, and they are now negotiating with their creditors. But nobody denies that Harrisburg owes the money. The legal effectiveness of the debt is not, excuse me for using this word, being questioned. So that's the difference between default and repudiation. Repudiation is saying, I don't owe you the money. Default is saying, yes, I owe you the money, but I don't have it. We're going to have to do something about it. And the question, the central question concerning Section 4 is, how far does Section 4 go? I think everybody agrees that the core of Section 4 is Congress can't repudiate the debt. Now, interestingly, Congress can repudiate other people's debts because Congress has the bankruptcy power, and Congress can provide for a discharge in bankruptcy. And the thing about a discharge in bankruptcy is it means the debt's gone. No continuing obligation. You don't have to pay it afterwards. Congress can do that for private parties. It can do that for Harrisburg. I don't think Harrisburg has yet filed for bankruptcy, but it could. There is a title of the bankruptcy code specifically for municipalities. Rich Hines is doing a lot of work on that right now. And Congress can say, yes, you can go bankrupt. And that then raises the question, can Congress say, we're going bankrupt?
Right.
We are going to eliminate our own, the obligation of our own debt. The core meaning, and I think everybody, as I say, I think everybody agrees on this, of the first sentence of Section 4 is Congress can't do that. Because to do that would not only question, but completely undermine the validity of the public debt of the United States. It would be, well, what does validity mean? This is the central question here. And this is the question on which I disagree with Abramowitz. So we've actually got sort of there are varying views on this, and this is the move that makes everything matter. What does it mean to say a debt is invalid?
Doesn't exist.
Yeah. That is the first thing it means. The issue about Section 4 is, does it mean anything more than that? Because for those of you who took a look at it, as you saw, Abramowitz's argument is, well, you have to be practical about these things. And suppose, he doesn't use these words, but I'll put it this way. And suppose you're somebody who is owed money, and the debtor comes to you and does what Harrisburg just did, and said, you know, we owe you $300 million. And you're right, we owe you $300 million. We don't have $300 million. Sorry. And just, you know, goes away. And Abramowitz's argument is that even though there might be some technical legal distinction between saying, no, we don't owe you the money, especially something a government in particular might do, and saying, we're not going to pay it, the practical effect of the two is the same. And hence, says Abramowitz, and say the people who think that Section 4 has some bearing on what's been going on, the key step is to say, not to pay constitutes questioning the validity of the public debt. Because practically speaking, it's as if the debt's not there if it is not paid. And interestingly, there are some real, you might think of them as constitutional interpretation methodological questions here. Do you understand a constitutional provision in terms of its purpose and assume the idea of a constitutional provision is that it always must be interpreted so as to carry out its purpose? And, well, the purpose of the first sentence of Section 4 is to get the debt paid. Or do you say, well, you know, whatever its purpose is, maybe it does something more specific than that.
Okay. How's this going to work? So I'm a bondholder.
Okay.
And now I come to the United States. They don't pay. They can't question the validity of the debt. So I go, I guess, Bromwich says this, I believe him. I go to the Court of Claims.
Mm-hmm.
I file my claim. They can't question, you're right, my contract claim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I get a judgment, right? Now you get the judgment.
Right, and you go to?
You go levy on the capital. I don't know. You know, you say you're going to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't it speak more, if we're going to go on the very practical level, doesn't it speak more to the government's continuing ability to borrow money rather than...
Yes, or something like that.
Well, yeah.
Right, and that is the next step. If you think, and this is what a lot of people who were blogging about this were talking about that. So suppose, and actually, if you want to look at what I've got there in Roman 1 of the outline, and don't worry, we probably won't get to section to part 4 of the outline, but that's not necessary. That was just dessert anyway. I've tried to come up with several different paraphrases of the first sentence of section 4 that provide more or less explicit answers to this question. What is it about, and is it limited to just dealing with repudiation, or does it go to default? So the first one is designed to be a provision that would just deal with default. Congress shall have no power, just about the power of Congress to do something about the legal obligation to pay the debt. Then the third and the fourth one are my ideas of what people have been thinking about, taking sort of the Abramowitz direction, what I think Jack Balkin was saying. Yeah, it goes beyond invalidating a law that would say no obligation to pay. And says, and something actually has to be done. And I hope you don't mind. I'm going to sort of call on you since you asked a question. Take a look at the third one and the fourth one there, both of which are going in that direction. What's the difference between them?
Well, the third one is about paying the outstanding
yes.
debt, and the fourth
yes.
one is about the ability to, in the future, borrow on the.
That's right. That's right. And the fourth one would tell the executive branch what to do in case of a cash shortfall. It would tell it to do what?
It raised the debt. So
exactly, mm-hmm. precisely. Whereas the third one. What does the third one say? It's that last clause that's doing the work. Exactly. Right. Well, the third. Yeah. Not George. You.
Yes. Well, if there's a statute on hand that says that they can't pay it, then they don't have to.
Right. Right. They don't have to do what? They don't have to follow that statute.
Yeah.
Well, not the statute that keeps them from paying it. Not just one that would say no legal obligation to keep them.
Yeah,
to,
but if there's right. a debt ceiling, pay beyond it. It doesn't say debt ceiling.
Exactly. Because besides the debt ceiling, what else keeps the Treasury from paying the debt in a cash shortfall situation?
The grocery bill. All the other bills.
All their other
appropriations.
Well, that's part of it. Exactly. That's the first part. Exactly. The problem is created to get back to what I said at the outset. The problem is created by an inconsistency among A, the debt ceiling, B, all the appropriations, including the appropriation, because there is one. I mentioned the standing appropriations for Medicare and Social Security. There's also the one to pay interest and principal on the debt. They don't appropriate that annually either. There's a statute that just runs on its own. So it's the debt ceiling, the appropriations, and besides borrowing, what's the other source of cash for the federal government? Exactly. And the interesting thing about this third one is that it is open-ended, and like Section 4 itself, it doesn't say exactly how you solve the problem. It just says you have to solve the problem. So it says, notwithstanding any provision of law that would prevent the timely payment of that debt. Whereas the fourth one actually says what some people were saying Section 4 says, which is the specific thing you do if you're in this problem is borrow more money. Because, yeah, when there's a cash shortfall, there are three things you can do. One is borrow more money. Two is not pay some of the other appropriations. And three, okay, what famous piece of legislation in the last 10 years might be limiting the amount of cash the government takes in? The Bush tax cuts, for example. So if you think of, all right, the debt ceiling is a statute that might be invalid because it's in the way of paying the debt. Well, if you think that, Section 4 means something like that third one, and notice again, Section 4 doesn't say what to do. So it doesn't give any particular guidance. It's not like the fourth one. It is, if anything, I think more like the. I think it's like the first one, but that's. But we're past that now. We're sort of over in Abramowitz land. But in Abramowitz land, the question is, okay, then what do you do? And it is especially difficult to argue that it's specifically four. It's more like three. Now that doesn't mean that if Section 4 means something like that third one, that doesn't necessarily tell you that the answer is not to borrow more money. The answer might be to borrow more money, but the Constitution itself is not telling you which of the possible solutions should be adopted. Now here's something that was shocking. My impression is that the Secretary of the Treasury said, well, maybe we have to go past the debt ceiling. That is, and most of what you think of among the blogging law professors, the liberals tended to say, well, of course, it's the debt ceiling that's in the way, and so we have to borrow more money. I don't know did anybody read any of Mike McConnell's posts on the Hoover blog? Just guess. Mike McConnell is a very prominent conservative law professor. So what do you think he thought was the solution?
No more appropriations. Cut.
Exactly. Precisely. Cut. 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 That is to say, prioritize spending. And McConnell said, and some people have said this about Section 4. I think John Duffy and I were talking about this. Is that what Section 4 means? Is that in the case of a cash shortfall, the payment on the debt gets priority among before other appropriations. That is to say, the Treasury neither borrows more nor raises taxes, but rather just says some other appropriation doesn't get paid. As I say, shockingly, that's the Republican solution as opposed to the Democrat, the Democratic solution.
And that's a statutory question. It's important to have this discussion.
Yeah, John and I were talking about this, and I want to think about that for a moment. But go ahead.
A question that Abramowitz comes up with is what's the intent of the public debt clause? And he talks a lot about, you know, textualists, the strict construction, all of that. And he says that, you know, that passage, the public debt clause, is for the purpose of the future, for fiscal honor. But how do we know that? He talks about the framers of the 14th Amendment, but where are their writings? What did they say?
What did Bingham say?
And I'm having trouble with that.
Well, yeah. Let me say again, George can tell me whether this is true or not. The actual available evidence, specifically about that first sentence from the Reconstruction debates, is very thin.
Okay.
And as a consequence, I mean, one reason I think that Abramowitz formulates it at a high level of abstraction is that we don't know in particular. It's entirely possible that people from the money center banks were talking to John Sherman, senator from Ohio, William Tecumseh Sherman's brother, who was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, later would be Secretary of the Treasury, was a genuine expert in federal finances. And yeah, it's certainly possible that there were conversations. If I were the head of a big New York bank, the person I would have gone to see in Washington would have been Senator Sherman. So that may well have happened. We don't have any direct evidence about that. It's not in John Sherman's memoirs, I don't think. Certainly, Senator Sherman didn't stand up and say, if we don't get this sentence, the banks will collapse. That's not in there. And so this is a situation where the intent has to be inferred from the circumstances.
He seems to suggest it's very clear.
He's a law professor.
Okay. All right. Then that's the problem.
Of course.
Wrote it.
Good point. Yeah, John makes also reminded me, who has co-authored with Bramowitz, that this and I should remember, this article actually began as his student note. So you see, you can become famous. Just say something. I strongly suspect that what happened is that Abramowitz went into Akil Amar and said, "I need a note topic," and Akil sort of specializes in parts of the Constitution you've never heard of. And so, why didn't you write about Section 4 of the 14th Amendment? And Abramowitz says, "What's that?" And that's how this. That's entirely speculation. You can check with Abramowitz and see if that's how it happened. It began as a student paper. So this just find something you think can't possibly matter and write about it. And 10 years later, it'll be blogged up. Anyway, the point that John just made, and I want to bring two things together here, is if you think that Section 4 means something like the third one, that is to say, it goes beyond saying there can't be actual repudiating legislation, and it says legislation that keeps the debt from being paid, whatever it says, it doesn't have to say we're repudiating, it can just say don't borrow this much, only whatever is the following tax rate, is invalid, has to not be followed. Well, why not? See? Yeah, and there are a couple of
can't invalidate the whole tax code and collect taxes.
This is, of course, the Republican plan. cut.
Then it's a pure question of statutory interpretation. It's a question of which provision falls, or it's like a severability.
Exactly. Two things here. The first point is the students here. How many of you have encountered severability yet? Okay. What can you remember about it?
We talked about it when we were in con law,
right?
Talking about the healthcare bill.
Right. Exactly.
So you have to decide whether the purposes of the statute can be affected absent the provision.
Precisely. You've got one provision. Assume one provision is unconstitutional. The question of severability is what happens to the rest of the statute, and the question that the courts ask is: had Congress known that they couldn't have this part? And it's interesting for healthcare because the individual mandate is pretty important, and it's a legitimate question. It might be the linchpin of the whole system, and it's entirely possible that you pull out like a linchpin, right? You pull it out, and the thing will collapse. And so the question for severability is: if a court decides that one part's unconstitutional, what does that mean of whether Congress would then want the other parts? And the reason this is like severability is what this version of Section 4 is saying is all these statutes taken together are unconstitutional. But no one of them by itself is unconstitutional, because it's the combination of them that creates the problem. It's the appropriations and the debt ceiling and the tax rates being what they are that altogether create the problem. And so under those circumstances, conventional ideas of unconstitutionality don't operate. There are rare occasions when it works like this. Interestingly, there are appointments clause problems like this, right, where the power and the mode of appointment can't go together.
Like the original Graham
Brundtland and Hollings, precisely. There was a constitutional challenge to a mechanism for deciding whether to have these sequestrations in the original Graham Brundtland Hollings Act. There's a major Supreme Court case about it, Boucher against Sinar, and that was a manifestation of this unusual thing where it's two things together that are unconstitutional. What happened in Graham Brundtland was certain power was given to the Comptroller General. The Comptroller General isn't a regular executive officer. And there's nothing the matter with having a Comptroller General, as long as the Comptroller General exercises only limited powers. There's nothing the matter with having somebody exercise these powers, but, said the Supreme Court, the Comptroller General can't do it. So that's how you get the problem that the two are okay in isolation, but together they're unconstitutional. Very rarely happens. This would be... If there were a cash shortfall and that third version were what Section 4 meant, this would be the mother of all of those. The entire federal fiscal system
as a system is unconstitutional, but no one part of it is unconstitutional. And so the natural thing, I think this is the direction John's going, the natural thing is then to treat it as a question of statutory construction and say, all right, which ones would Congress want to go first? Which would Congress want to blow by the debt ceiling? Would Congress want to raise income tax withholding? Would Congress want to...
They might not be able to do
cut
that.
Spending.
They might not be able to do that.
Well,
because you said that they could say that the Bush tax cuts are unconstitutional.
Yes.
At least there's a law.
That's right.
Could say
excellent point.
That law
absolutely
has to be viewed as
absolutely
nullity.
Yes.
I don't think you could say if there's something that says my tax rate is 20%, it's been that way forever. You can say, well, we're going to jump that up to 22%.
John, there are two things, and John has gotten one of them ahead of the queue that I want you to think about that are really interesting. And that are part of what you might think of as the infrastructure of how the Constitution works, that is to say, the actual technical parts of it. Think about the debt ceiling actually is an even better example of this. The Bush tax cuts are also an example of it, but the debt ceiling is a great example of it. What you may have seen this, I think, what's his name, the new guy from Senator Lee. When they were debating the bill to raise, did you see this?
From Utah.
Okay. What did he say?
He just said
he was talking about this argument.
Yeah.
Right.
He just said that. Just basically that it was unconstitutional to even do it at all. Right.
He said. I think this is right, and I think this is what you're saying. That. The Geithner Section 4 argument is nonsense. And the reason it's nonsense is, who has the power to borrow money?
The Congress.
Congress, exactly. And people, some people have been saying, look, this can't possibly be true. Only Congress can borrow the money. It says authorized by law. What are you talking about? Well, this is another recurring thing in con law that hardly anybody ever thinks about. Yes, it is true that the power to borrow money is only in Congress, and the president has no constitutional authority to borrow money. And so it is possible that there are circumstances where you might think that the only possible solution to a constitutional problem would be to borrow more money, but the president can't do it because only Congress can authorize borrowing money. But, and this is the point that John was making a minute ago, and I mentioned this before, the structure of the statutes that govern federal borrowing is there are, it's in Title 31, which is a part of the U.S. Code you've probably never heard of before, but in fact it's what causes the whole system to work, because that's where the fiscal stuff is. There are three provisions in Title 31 that says the Secretary of the Treasury can borrow money needed to pay appropriations. No cap in those. The one right before them, 3101, is the debt ceiling. Okay, so when you put it that way, and this is the fundamental point, it's true that borrowing power, like a lot of power, has to come from Congress, and the executive doesn't have it on its own. But if Congress has structured things so that there is a general power and a restriction on it, and the restriction can be separately unconstitutional. It would have to be, here you'd have another severability problem. It would have to be severable. You'd have to think Congress would have enacted the general borrowing authority without, which maybe not, right? I see you thinking, would they really want this to happen? Possibly not.
Well, maybe they do still want the Treasury to be able to pay their debt.
Right. They might. But it's a hard question because they're serious about the ceiling too. So yeah, so there's a severability problem, but the solution to the point that the problem that Senator Lee was making, was raising, which is, but the president has no authority to borrow the money, is actually he does. It's in the other statutes. And if you can take the statutes apart like that and say, yeah, the power is intact and the restriction's gone. Gee, the executive always likes that. The power is intact and the restriction's gone. Sounds perfect. And the point John was making a couple of minutes ago is that you could think of the Bush tax cuts as being like that. That is to say, there's the way the Internal Revenue Code stood before that alteration to it. And there was that change in it. And you might think, okay, the problem is that change. And you can take out that change and go back to where it was before. But the crucial thing is, if you take seriously the idea that only Congress can raise taxes and only Congress can borrow money and only Congress can appropriate funds, there has to be that substratum in existence before that you could go back to. And frequently there will be. That by the way, was 2A on the outline. The other point I want to make, and I don't know if any of the con law blogging professors said anything about this, but think about what we've been saying. We're saying there's a constitutional provision, and that the constitutional provision makes something unconstitutional, and therefore, have I mentioned a court yet?
I did. You never answered my question.
Exactly, because I put it off. Because we are talking about, and Secretary Geithner was talking about, who is going to decide that this is unconstitutional?
The court?
No. In the first instance, who would go out and borrow that money?
Exactly.
Absolutely. So, here is the president saying on his own, this statute is unconstitutional and I'm not going to follow it. Does that sound familiar?
Sure. Bush, Truman.
For instance, this
he's
is
a con law professor, so you know why not?
How could
yeah,
he
but,
be wrong?
Yeah, but you know, I don't know whose article it was. Maybe it was. He says nothing in the 14th Amendment or any other constitutional provision suggests the president may usurp legislative power to prevent a violation of the Constitution. Of course, mm-hmm. they can. Of course, the president can. They've done it in the past, or they tried to. The steel seizure case, for example. Not about that, but
the president lost that one. Though.
I know he did. I know
he did.
But
he did. He did lose that.
There've been many attempts of presidents to usurp legislative power, as the Bush administration. The whole.
Well, that is the question I'm asking. I'm asking you to think about is this proposal that the executive branch would just say, yeah, this is unconstitutional and we're not going to follow it. By the way, I think is totally correct. I'm a departmentalist and a believer in executive review because I believe that the executive branch is just like a private citizen. And if you're a private citizen and you're subject to a statute that you think is unconstitutional, Eichmann, who is Eichmann, right?
Are there no constraints on it then? So could the president raise the marginal income tax rate if they wanted to?
My answer would be there are then these questions. That is to say, is there an identifiable statutory provision like the debt ceiling that the president can say is unconstitutional or has to go out because it's the one that goes first under these circumstances? And what is it, and what should I do if it is invalid? And I think there's a difference. I mean, the question whether the president can usurp executive power. I think that there is a difference between the president. For example, you suppose that the president thought the thing Congress would want to do under these circumstances would be raise some more revenue. I think that saying the Bush tax cuts go because they are an identifiable decision that might be eliminated, like the debt ceiling, would be very different from saying we're going to start having a consumption tax. Congress never enacted a consumption tax at all. It did enact the Internal Revenue Code with those higher rates, and then it moved the rates back down.